The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life. With joy, I celebrate the virtue that relieves all beings from the sorrows of the states of loss and places those who languish in the realms of bliss. And I rejoice in virtue that creates the cause of gaining the enlightened state and celebrate that freedom won by living beings from the round of pain. And through these actions now performed and by all virtue I have just amassed, may all the pain of every living being be wholly scattered and freed. This is an excerpt from this chapter on raising bodhicitta by Shantideva that we chant periodically here in the Zendo. And it's part of this larger text, which is a really foundational text. The Dalai Lama said that if he has any compassion, has brought any compassion into the world, it is largely due to Shantideva's teaching. And so I just wanted to speak a little bit about this. Ceasing from harm, to practice good, which means to practice virtuous actions in accord with the precepts, and to train the mind. And the mind, the body, the heart, all one gorgeous, complicated, living thing. Why so much emphasis on the mind in Buddhism? The first verse in the Dhammapada by the Buddha: mind precedes all mental states. It is their chief. They are all mind-wrought. If with an impure, tethered mind, a person speaks or acts, suffering will follow them like the wheel that follows the foot of the ox. If with a pure or unbound mind a person speaks or acts, then happiness follows them like their never-departing shadow. So the Buddha realized that all things arise from mind. Mind is the basis of all mental, emotional, physical, psychological experiences. It is the basis of every karmic action, the experience of the consequences of those actions. There is no world in the human realm without mind. There is no practice. The mind of samsara is caught, right, in webs. And webs are kind of a good analogy, you know, like a spider web. When an insect lands in a web, you know, it acts frantically. It's painful to watch, right? They're frantically flying, trying to pull away. They're caught. And for us, those are webs of thoughts and emotions and memories and experiences and beliefs and a body-mind-name complex. Body, because everything we experience in the physical realm as a physical sensation. Mind, inclusive of every mental, emotional arising. And name, in terms of everything we call something, every concept. And what we see is that, or what the teachings are clear about, is it's not enough just to calm the mind. We're not trying to just stop thinking. It's very important to understand that. If the mind is racing and unfettered, and or fettered, rather, and just, you know, wild, then it's very difficult to practice. I mean, we can practice that mind, but we have to really go further. That mind has to begin to resume a more natural, original state, which is perfectly capable of. But being untrained, it tends to be a little wild. Maybe you have some sense of that. Just guessing. And so it's not ultimately about never having thoughts, because we will also have thoughts, always have thoughts, at some point, at the same time that it's natural in Zazen as it deepens to have moments that are free of thought. It's natural and important that the quality, the nature, the tenor, the speed, the power of those thoughts become more appropriate to what they are, which is easy, impermanent, flowing naturally, coming in and dropping away easily. But what's more important is what happens when a thought arises, that we don't get caught in it, we don't throw ourselves into that web, that we don't use it as a basis for more discrimination, for more proliferation. In other words, we run away. It's like the thought is thinking me. That just the calming of the mind is what many forms of meditation, perhaps most, are aiming for, or sort of that's the fruit of that. Because it is transformative. You experience yourself differently. It does have a transformative effect on your life, but it's temporary, and it only goes so deep. But once that begins to shift, then the whole complex, mind, body, name, inner and outer, is coming into a more restful place. And restful not just being a state of relaxation, but being illuminated, bright, clear. So now the heart, the mind, thoughts are not constrained, are not being governed by fear and anxiety, by greed. So now compassion can more naturally come forth. And Buddhism teaches, particularly in the Mahayana, that my wisdom and compassion are just two hands of one body, two aspects of the same thing. They're not separable. So now, as that begins to develop, when I make an intention in my mind, when I raise an aspiration, when I engage a teaching, when I invoke a heartfelt wish, that can now go very deep. The ground is open. We can speak about it as being receptive, which is kind of a pale way to describe it. It's more penetrating. Now the mind is the chief of wisdom, of compassion, of clear seeing, of loving kindness, rather than of, you know, all the troublemaking stuff. And so that's why Shantideva begins, "With joy I celebrate those virtues that relieves beings from the sorrows of the states of loss." Hallelujah, let's celebrate them, right? Let's make them important in our mind. If those are not important, then something else is. Dogen said, if we're not taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right, in wisdom and compassion, we're taking refuge in something else. We're relying on something else. So he says, I celebrate those virtues. And so in this, what Shantideva is doing and in inviting us into is to plant the seeds within our own mind of joy and rejoicing in those qualities that you have, that I have, in this body and mind. To cultivate, encourage ourselves to want deeply for these to come forth, to be strong, vibrant, alive, generous. And then that naturally will lead us to feel sadness and sorrow and pain when we're not doing that and when others are not doing that. And that's just part of what you take on. Right? It's not a I get mine and the rest of you are on your own. Your sadness becomes my sadness. It's not the same. I don't know your sadness. I'm not experiencing your sadness. But because the heart has been opened, because that boundary, those walls in the mind are dissolving or coming down, that clear boundary between me and you, what's mine, what's yours, because that's dissolving or just not being created. It's not really dissolving. We're not deconstructing as though there is a construction. We're just not creating. Then the pain of the world kind of gets more. I mean, Avalokiteshvara, who's the embodiment of boundless compassion, well, one day her head blew up. Okay, that was a hard day for her, right? So I take some comfort in that. Not that I want her head to blow up, but if her head can blow up, then my moments of being overwhelmed, right, is like, okay, I can hold that. And she had to get her head put back together again, right? Because it wasn't over, right? So in my moments of overwhelm, that's just a moment. Now I have to keep going, take another step, take a breath. So delighting in those thoughts and words and actions that bring forth our natural qualities of generosity and patience, loving kindness. This mind that sincerely invokes and wishes for and works towards this, what's happening is your mind is changing. Now, of course, we could say, well, the mind is impermanent. It's always changing. But on the basis of what? You could say your body is always changing, growing. On the basis of what? Well, the food you eat, the air you breathe, and what we realize is much more than that. The thoughts you think, the images you both see and create, the sounds, right? Those are good ones. Or other kinds of, because we're sentient beings, we're sensory beings, and so the world flows in and affects us. And part of practice is to not be so tethered to those effects, not be at the mercy. But it doesn't mean to not feel, to not have influence, be influenced. And so we're changing our mind under the influence of those enlightened qualities that you possess and I possess, and that teachers like Shantideva gives voice to. It changes the mind of the person who invokes, who wishes for, who is working towards. And it creates karma. It creates, in Buddhist sense, merit. It helps us return to our true place. I rejoice in the virtue that creates the cause of gaining the enlightened state. He's not just sitting back and rejoicing. Somebody's throwing a party over there and he's enjoying it. He's in it. He's devoted his whole life to creating those causes and to encouraging us to do the same and celebrate the freedom won by living beings from the round of pain, from samsara. When the mind is immersed in pain and suffering, right, we have to learn how to take that in and let it move through, right? The image that I have had for a long time and use is like a house, right? The Buddha likened this to a house where every door and every window is wide open, right? So stuff blows in, but it passes through. Doesn't get caught, doesn't get trapped. Closing all the doors and windows is not protection. It's not helping. But opening the front doors and closing the back ones also isn't helping. Things get trapped. And so to be immersed or to be in the presence of, right? I remember when I was working on this morning, I was remembering many years ago, Jimon and I were in Chinatown when we were at the temple having lunch. It was very crowded and we were in these little tiny tables and we were sitting having lunch. And a man who was part of NYPD, a police officer, came in and he sat down right next to us. And there was something that just got my attention about this guy. He was beautiful. He just seemed very, I don't know, majestic and very, he got my attention. Something about him had power. And he sat down, and because we were basically sitting cheek to jowl, I just, like we were having lunch at the same table, I turned to him and I said, "You're a police officer." He said, "Yes." I said, "Can I ask you a question?" He said, "Sure." And I said, "When you go out every day and spend all day looking for trouble, looking for the people who are causing trouble, how does that not become your whole world? He said, you have to have another life outside of this. He said, you have to go home and have other worlds that you enter into. He said, unfortunately, a lot of people he works with don't do that. And he said, it colors your whole mind. That becomes the world. He said, it's not the whole world. And I asked him, I said, how long have you been doing this? And he said, I don't know, some number of years. I said, what were you doing before this? He says, I was a kindergarten teacher. Well, that just about makes sense. I said, why did you become a cop? He said, I wanted to help. We have to see that there's a world outside of the world that we might be immersed in. Shantideva goes on to say, for all those ailing in the world, until their every sickness has been healed, I myself become for them the doctor, the nurse, the medicine itself. My body thus and all my goods besides and all my merits gained and to be gained, I give them all away, withholding nothing to bring about the benefit of beings. Nirvana is attained by giving all. Nirvana, the objective of my striving, everything, therefore, must be abandoned, relinquished, and it is best to give it all to others. So he's really presenting the bodhisattva vow. And to make himself the medicine, so whatever is needed. And of course, it's poetry, it's metaphor. But it's like, how can I offer? The bodhisattva is confident that in any situation, in any encounter, there's something that they can offer. Which means that they don't disregard subtle offerings, simple offerings, everyday, ordinary offerings. That's why giving is one of the first practices of the bodhisattva. That's a language everybody knows. And then goes further, my body and all my goods besides. And there are lots of stories like the Jataka tales of the Buddha before he became the Shakyamuni, all these previous lives. And he came across a tiger who couldn't feed her pups because she was so starved. And so he gave his own body and flesh to her so she could eat and gain sustenance and feed her pups, right? And so there are a lot of teachings that point to giving your whole body and mind away. And then periodically a teacher would say, if you're not quite ready for that, don't do that, which is us, right? And again, it's talking about, okay, so it's not about, you know, in a literal sense, but what of my body and mind? What of what I consider me? Am I holding on too fast? That might be helpful, could be helpful, could be of service. And that whatever I give away, and ultimately in Buddhism, non-attachment is everything. It's just not being bound. And that non-attachment is to give whatever I have to others. That's what we're here for. That's why we have this body and mind. That's why we can think and talk. That's why we have a body that can meditate. So that we can awaken ourselves and at every step along the way now truly be of service, help, give. So how can we offer ourselves? Which means we have to want to. We have to be willing to. Which means we cultivate those things. That's what Shantideva is trying to help us to do. To even begin to think about that. What? I mean, I've talked many times about it in the beginning. It was like, wait a minute, that's just like, I'm just not ready for that. You're asking too much. I'm not that person. I was that person. I just didn't know it. I also wasn't sure I wanted that because I thought, well, what am I giving up? What's left for me? And what we realize is that in giving, it's not like a tank of gas, right? You get empty, the car doesn't move. It's not like that. This is like a self-replenishing thing. To give, to relinquish attachments, to be generous, not withholding. Whatever we have to offer. That's why some depictions of Avalokiteshvara is with 100 arms. In each arm and each hand is a different implement. a pencil, a slide rule. You don't know what a slide rule is anymore. A ruler, a computer, a spatula, screwdriver, a napkin, a diaper, whatever's needed. And that this giving is not a self-denial, right? Self-denial comes from a sense of self that is contained, that is fixed, that is finite, that can only give so much. It's not self-denial, it's self-liberation. And of course, we do live within a body. We do live within 24 hours of a day. We have other responsibilities, all of us do. Those are part of it, it's all part of it. Dr. Roshi used to talk about Vincent van Gogh when he was a minister, and he was so troubled by the poverty that he encountered. He just gave everything he had away, and then he became the impoverished. Self and other. One teacher talked about how we can generate compassion for somebody that we care about. And we see them, and we care for them, and we feel responsible for them. When they're no longer in our presence, maybe we still think about them, maybe we don't. But it's limited. This person, that person. That's not the compassion of a bodhisattva. That's what we're cultivating. Boundless. That's why parental love is used as a way to think about for those of you who are parents. Or for any of us who love someone or something so much that we would just easily, freely give ourselves. Give it away for that person. The cultivation of compassion, boundless compassion, is to see all beings that way. So there's a metaphor of alchemy, of transforming iron into gold. Transforming an ordinary person, right, into a bodhisattva, into a Buddha. Shanti Deva said, all those who slight me to my face or do me any kind of harm, even if they blame or slander me, may they attain the fortune of enlightenment. Just as all the Buddhas of the past embrace the awakened attitude of mind, and in the precepts of the Bodhisattvas, step by step, abode and trained, just so, and for the benefit of all beings, I will also have the same attitude of mind, and in those precepts, step by step, I would abide and train myself. So Shanti Deva is saying, this is what's been passed down to us. This is what everybody before us has done within the Buddha's path. So seeing that, I now can do that. I will do that. And there are a lot of teachings that talk about being slighted, disrespected, slandered, mistrusted. And I have to think that that was something that was happening for Buddhists. I mean, it just happens to be misspoken to, hurt, abused. And the emphasis here is on, as the Buddha said, being hurt by someone, like an arrow being shot into your heart, not shooting a second arrow. Revenge, retaliation, anger, bitterness, grudge. But rather turning that around, rather than being angry at this person, wishing, like, because they're in pain, why would someone hurt someone else? They never do that because they are so happy, so joyful, so patient, so generous, so loving. Mm-mm. They do that because they are in pain. And that is their responsibility, but it's ours too, right? Because we're kind of in this together. And my pain doesn't just stay my pain, it becomes your pain when I act out on it. And so what Shanti Deva says is take those negative thoughts or emotions that I would direct, right, in anger towards that person and transform them into the desire that that person be free of those negative thoughts and emotions, that they be enlightened, that they become compassionate. Now we're both being helped. That's why I've said it's, you know, when I do the four measurables as my own practice every day, you know, part of that is I bring into my mind the real troublemakers, the people many people love to hate, right? Because I think, oh my God, if this person became kinder, infused with loving kindness, that would be so good, I'm telling you. Right? And I feel it, right? I want that for them. Bodhidharma said, the Bodhisattva takes the Dharma realm as their home and the four immeasurable minds as the locus of the precepts. All behavior to the end does not go outside of the Dharma realm mind. Why? Because the body mind is the Dharma realm. So the Bodhisattva takes the four measurable, the mind of the four measurables, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, your happiness is my happiness, and equanimity, as the locus of the precepts. So he's making this Bodhidharma, a very clear relationship between the precepts, moral teachings, and the four measurables. Changing your mind. Which I used to, when I thought of it that way, I was like, oh, is that like brainwashing? Right? But we're kind of being brainwashed all the time. I mean, that's kind of what samsara is. Right? It's to reclaim the mind and now say, okay, what mind do I want to bring to you? What mind do I want to bring forth? What's getting in the way of that? How do I work with this mind? It's not turning a toaster into a bicycle. It's taking empty space that in one moment is filled with storm clouds and another moment is bright and sunny. It's the same sky. Maybe that's why when we go against our own good qualities, when we go against our basic nature, it hurts, right? That's one of the things we start to discover as we become more sensitive in mind and body to what we're actually experiencing, that when we actually act, we kind of transgress against ourselves. I mean, it's easier to feel that when we transgress against others. But when we transgress against ourselves, that it's actually painful. I mean, I have to think that that's because that isn't our nature. That's not our basic nature. So when we injure that, when we go against that, it's painful. Just like when you cut yourself, it hurts. And that pain is like to get our attention. Mend thyself. Now, of course, if somebody is causing harm, slandering, abusing, misspeaking, and so on, right? If we have the power to do something about that, we should. It doesn't mean just transform it in your mind and let them keep doing what they do. Sometimes we don't have the control, the power to make them do otherwise. Very often that is true. I mean, actually, we don't really have the power to make anybody do much of anything differently. I mean, we could change somebody to a cushion, but we can't make them do zazen. I mean, in fact, we're going to drive them away from wanting to do zazen. That's why each of us has to come here freely. So in these precepts, I will train myself. And the precepts, the Dharma, I think of it as, if you think of it as something, it can hold anything you've got coming, anything you've ever thought, anything you've ever said, anything you've ever done, doesn't matter how wicked it might be. The precepts will not reject you. They do not turn away from you. The Dharma doesn't have a door. It's not a thing, so it's just a way of thinking. Because the Dharma understands we have that capacity. We can do all of that crazy stuff. But it also understands that that's not really who we are. That's not our basic nature. And so we can be angry and blaming and disrespecting of ourselves and others. We can do all kinds of things, and most of us have. We can act out of our afflictive emotions. But we don't have to. We don't have to. But how do I not do that? When so often, in so many situations, that seems like the easiest thing to do. And I've tried just saying, okay, stop, don't do that anymore. But I do it again. So the Buddha gave us a path. We have to do something. If I want to get from here to your home, I have to get there, right? I have to move my feet. I have to get my butt off the couch. I have to commit to something. When we face others who are not training themselves, who are not trying to bring forth loving kindness and compassion, who are not interested in patience, generosity, and tolerance, or opening their heart, might think that that's stupid, ridiculous, weak, right? You're just going to be taken advantage of. Everybody else is going to be getting theirs, and you're just being, you know, something else. So when facing others who are not training themselves, for whom such things may not be important, other things are important, acting out of their kleshas, the challenge of the practitioner is to not succumb to our own kleshas. Right? Seeing a fire, don't build a bigger one. It's easy to do. So how is it when the mind of anger and blame and hatred and violence and cruelty is a fire that is built and built and built and encouraged, and you're given a job? You know, I think of people who are in the job of ICE. I went on the website recently and looked, you know, what is required if you want to apply for a job? They're giving you a lot of stuff. I hope that means because they're not getting many takers, but I'm not sure. But I'm more worried about the ICE pretenders, the people who are just looking for an opportunity to go out and be cruel. Because that fire is built at the highest levels. That's being encouraged. That's okay. Avalokiteshvara's head is exploding every day. or not, maybe not. I don't know. I'm not going to speak for her. That this most pure and spotless state of mind might be embraced and constantly increased, the prudent who have cultivated should praise it highly in such words as these. Today, my life has given fruit. This human state has now been well assumed. Today, I take my birth in Buddha's line and have become the Buddha's child and heir. It's like I'm a blind person who found a precious gem within a mound of filth. So Shantideva says, take this ardent desire, this spotless state of mind, this boundless compassion, this skillfulness, this intelligence. And Buddhism compassion is not just a feeling of wanting to alleviate suffering, it's working at it, which means we have to be smart about it. Bring as much intelligence, skillfulness, common sense as we can. That state of mind, he says, embrace it and increase it. Cultivate it like a garden. That's what daily practice is. In any practice-based spiritual tradition, there is a spring that you have to go drink from, and you have to keep going down to that spring and drinking from it. That's the lifeblood. That's why we talk about being a practitioner. It means to be doing that which is the path, right? And that has to include, does include, everything. Work, family, house, you know, any interest, right? To bring all of that into the path. Those are all areas in which we can bring forth what Shantideva is encouraging us to cultivate. So in my relationships, in my families, in my work, I mean, that's what I bring forth in my liturgy. May this be a benefit. If I'm going to do something, I want it to help. You know, it's like we sit here on the cushion, we bring our here, and then if we spend the whole morning daydreaming, like, that's not helping. To sit there and indulge that is not helping. To just have the mind arise, that's practice. But to be passive in this or complacent, that's just not helping, right? We're not going to live forever, actually. Sorry to break the news. An old teacher said, meditators who have meditative experience but do not practice them in everyday life are like a rich person who takes all their wealth and just goes out into a cyclone and just tosses it. Or like a lion who roams with stray dogs, or a precious stone in a swamp. In other words, having something beautiful, powerful, could really be helpful, and we're not utilizing it because we do not bring that into. And that's the hardest thing. So if you find that difficult, it's not just you. When I first came here, we had a program of training where you could live here and work out during the day. So I had a house cleaning business. So every day I'd go out with my partner and we'd clean houses. Simple work, perfect caretaking practice, right? And every day I'd start in Zazen, stable, feeling good, and I'd go out and just watch the whole thing unravel. And I'd just be cleaning houses, like, what's my problem? That's what I would think. Why can't I maintain this? I would get so frustrated. I just didn't understand how strong those habits were of my distractedness and how challenging it is to integrate, to unify, to make it seamless. I thought I should just be able to do it because I wanted to. The analogy of if you want to start a fire by rubbing two sticks together, you know, once they start getting hot and smoking, you can't stop and take a break, right? You have to keep going. And so there's that sense of continuation, right? And again, this is all integrated within a life, right? It's not all work and no play. There's lots of play. Make it all play if you want. Make it all work if you want. Those are just names. Last week I talked about things that are going on in the world, and as practitioners, as a place of training, as a monastery, what is our individual, our sort of collective role? How do we see and hear and respond? And so I talked about that last week, and I was thinking more about that. You know, I talked about how, you know, I think about this a lot. The teachers talk about and discuss this a lot. It's kind of an ongoing reflection. And, you know, some of the things that we consider is that, you know, this is a monastery. So it is established in a way as a refuge, a place to come from, right, the world of samsara, into a place where we are all gathered together for this very express purpose of practicing the Dharma and creating the most conducive, you know, elements possible for us to do that, to encourage. And so that balance, you know, of how, in a sense, how much of that the world, you know, particularly in its very upsetting or disturbing elements, to bring in conscious way, in talks and so on. Right? So that's one of the reasons during Sesshin I've asked the teachers and students not to, you know, bring into their talks stuff that's just really upsetting. Not because we want to ignore it or escape from it, because in Sesshin people are really trying to we've closed the gate. Right? Nobody's reading the news. And we're trying to let go of our normal engagement so that we can really go much deeper into our practice and then take that back out. And so it's intentional. If we never acknowledge it, then it can sound like somehow, well, it's not part of Dharma practice. Or we're ignoring it, or I've just been on this mountain too long. right? I mean, it's kind of true. Most of the people I meet are you. So based on that, world looks pretty good, right? People are really doing good work, caring about the right thing, right? So I have to keep remembering. And, you know, it's like with, I mean, what is political, what is not political? But to, you know, to recognize that I don't know what people's beliefs are. This is not about everybody having one belief, being one party, voting for all the same person. It's not about that, right? But within things, there's always a moral element. Whatever the party, the ideology, the position, there's always a moral element. Is it life affirming or is it life destroying? That's everywhere. That's in everything. And so that's what we try to speak about. Because that's what the Dharma's been speaking about since the beginning. How do we make ourselves and others miserable? We don't have to do that. How do we practice not doing that? How do we live in a world that's still doing that? How do we see what we actually can do? How do we reckon with what we don't have control over? How do we hold all of those exquisite tensions? You know, it's why just being dogmatic on one end or being completely apathetic and complacent on the other end seems to solve the problem. One idea, one slogan, just follow that. Don't think, don't ask. A kind of blind trust. And the other is, just don't care. Well, that's just not happening on the Bodhisattva path, because there is no life there. There is no giving, there is no service, there's no... And it's all of these reflections. It's also one of the reasons that the Sangha is invited to self-mobilize, right? In other words, if there are things within the Sangha that an individual or group of people want to get involved in it. You know, it doesn't have to come from the teachers or from the training office. If you're going to be doing something that's speaking for this community or is interacting with the larger community as this community, then yeah, I'd like to know about that, right? So that we're sure that we're in alignment. But Sangha is welcome to get involved in whatever you want as an individual body, but, you know, enabled in a sense because you're practitioners. And there are people doing that, but that's just important to know. Because people are different. You're different. The way you see and feel about things, the way you think about things, how you want to engage and respond to things is different. And sometimes people have brought stuff up, and there are listservs within the Sangha, Sangha treasure listserv, to sort of put that kind of information out, see if anybody bites. And sometimes it coalesces into something, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I think of, these are really important matters for us. I mean, particularly myself, the teachers, to really think about, you know, as a Dharma community, that we are creating this. I say that a lot, right? This isn't just a thing. And that if we all go to sleep, it's just going to keep happening. It's not. Something's going to happen, but it's not necessarily going to be Dharma. It's not necessarily going to be Dharma worthy of being practiced. That's an effort. You know, it's like you got to keep cleaning your house, right? There's something about it. It just gets dirty if you don't. And it doesn't just need cleaning, it actually needs maintenance, improving, make it better. So it's very engaged. And so how do we do that? Maintaining this profound wisdom tradition that has come down to us and maintaining the depth of that, the integrity of that, the fire, the lamp of that, and respond to our time and place. And that's a tension that doesn't go away. It's not a question you ask and get answered. It's not like that. It's a living thing. And we're all part of it. And so I just wanted to share some of those things, because we talk a lot about, and but you know, there's a lot that happens between conversations, and how would the Sangha know? But these are things that we discuss a lot because we want the Dharma to flourish. We want the Sangha to flourish, and we want the Dharma that we're all practicing here to be directly meaningful, translatable, right? Alive in your life, in all of our lives. Today my life has given fruit. This human state has now been well assumed because we encountered the Dharma. We have this opportunity. We can do this. I take my birth in the lineage of Buddhas and ancestors. Then he goes on to say, exactly so, as if by some strange chance, the mind that aspires to enlightenment has come to birth in me. It's a universal vehicle that alleviates suffering. It's open to everyone. It's not specific to Buddhism. All wandering beings from the states of loss possess this. What do they possess? That rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrow born of the afflictions. I love that line. That rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrow born of the afflictions. And then he calls out, living beings, wayfarers upon life's path, who wish to taste the riches of contentment, here before you in this Dharma practice is the supreme bliss. Here, O ceaseless wanderers, is the fulfillment that you seek. Now, of course, he's speaking to people who are on the path. And not everybody, I'm assuming, is in this hall is on that path. But this is, he's speaking from that place. And so, he says, within the sight of all protectors, all the Buddhists and ancestors, I call every being, call them to Buddhahood, call them to a path. A true path. It might be a Buddhist path. It might be a Christian path. It might be an atheist path. It might be a path within the earth. It might be a path of your own making, but make it true. Make sure it's true. Make sure it's worthy. And so within the sight of all protectors, I summon every being calling them to Buddhahood. Until that state is reached, to every earthly joy, may gods and demigods and beings in every realm rejoice. So he ends with a hallelujah. And I think that's just an interesting and wonderful quality aspect of Buddhism that's been noticed since the beginning, is that it brings our attention and to come very close to and face directly some of those difficult aspects, the most difficult aspects of human life, right? The things we would rather ignore, deny. And it invites us, because that is not a viable path, it invites us to face what is difficult to face because there is a path. And that in that, unexpectedly for me, was joy, lightness, brightness, right? Not a funereal, solemn, bleak desert landscape. Mm-mm. And again, I think that's because we're reaching into our basic nature. And so that joy is just an affirmation. Is this true? Yes, this is true.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.